This is the Ray Lucia Show.
I'm going to the best for the answers here.
The one show that helps you make better money moves. The program all about your money, your business, and your life.
You guys have about a lot of really good information that even I can understand.
Call Ray now at 844-RAY-SHOW, 844-RAY-SHOW. This is the Ray Lucia Show.
Thank you very much. Thank you, and welcome to the one talk show in America that helps you make better money moves. The show all about your money, your business, and your life. Welcome. I'm Ray Lucia, along with Johnny Dean, tackling your money questions right here live on your radio and television nationwide and coast to coast. Hello, Johnny.
Hey there. Well, we got a lot of stuff to talk about, as we always do. We're never sitting here saying, oh, we got nothing to talk about. Stuff that was actually left over from last week, discussions from last week. We had an email come in over the weekend. I hope we have a chance to get to it. And I mentioned this to our TV audience a few minutes ago, and I'll mention this now for people who are watching and listening. It has to do with charitable giving. There are ways, a lot of people, in fact, I think you have an article on this, have said they're not going to be giving money to charity this year because they don't get an itemized deduction for it. They don't get a tax break for it. What I'm talking about is somebody who's already charitably inclined, as we like to say, somebody who's going to give money to a charity anyway. And in my particular situation, I'm going to be talking, what I want to bring up, and the emailer brought up, had to do with somebody who is at least required minimum distribution age, which is over 70 and a half. How you may be able to get what they call a de facto deduction for it, even if your standard deduction is higher and you're not itemizing.
We'll talk about that in just a moment. Johnny Dean will bring up whatever he wants to bring up, because he does anyway.
Phew, you better believe
but
it.
But I will start with this one. Trading stocks is a fool's game. And many times, if you want to be successful, just be boring. Sit back, folks. Relax. It is the Ray program. Yeah, this is interesting because I'm reading a couple of stories here. All right, let me just read you the headlines.
All right, okay.
All right, because I don't want to read these, but I do want to talk a little bit about it. Why so many NFL and NBA players go broke.
Oh,
that's
yeah.
One headline. And then this one caught my attention early this morning. Stocks making the biggest moves pre-market. It's like, who cares? And they bring up Boeing because there's another plane. There have been a couple of Boeing
incidents. But who knows?
737, MAX 8s or whatever that have crashed. And, of course, if Boeing gets pummeled, the entire Dow goes down several hundred points at the open.
And the funny thing was, lately, Boeing had been doing really, really well.
Really, really well. So what I did when I saw this story, I printed it out and then I typed in, trading stocks is a fool's game.
And you got that same headline.
I put it on the headline. Mm-hmm. It's not part of the story.
Oh, I thought it was.
No, I wrote that in. That's my headline.
You have your own headlines now. Good for you.
Yeah. So I got thinking about what happens when a stock is removed from the Standard & Poor's 500 and replaced by yet another stock. We covered this a couple weeks ago. But Jeremy Siegel has studied this thing for years. And what he says is this, 82% of the stocks that are removed from the S&P outperform the stock that replaced them. And it got me thinking about, man, there's a lot of really smart people at Dow Jones and at S&P that are making these decisions as to which stocks should be in and which stocks should be out. And they're not smart enough to figure this out? I mean, come on. 82% of the time, they're screwing the people that stay in the index. I mean, it really is crazy. And it also brings up this whole thing of passive investing, index investing, and whether or not you would be better served with maybe an equal weight index instead of a market capitalization weighted index. So it's certainly something that you want to be discussing with your financial planning team. Now, why did I say financial planning team?
Well, I know why. Are you going to bring it up? Do you want to?
Oh, go ahead. Take a stab at it.
Well, because a team, here's the deal. When you have a financial planner, we're talking about somebody that does, a financial planner is somebody who puts together your strategy, talks to you about what you have. But you've also got somebody who has to implement that strategy.
Can you use the architect analogy?
I'd love to.
Okay,
I think that's pretty darn good.
There you go.
Maybe that was the one we were talking about last week.
Might have been.
You want to build a custom home. Everybody's got their own ideas. So you go to an architect and you tell the architect, here are my goals. The architect looks at this and says, well, let's see what we can do. So they build something. They design a plan, a strategy for your home. And they say, yeah, we can do this, and I think this would look good. This would suit your needs. So you say, great, this is exactly what I want. It gets me to my goals of whatever my goals are for my home. But then the architect says, okay, I've got these plans. Somebody's got to build them. Somebody actually has to go in and hammer and nail all this stuff and make sure it's all up to code and make sure that it works. And I don't know anything about building materials. So I go to the builder. And the builder says, sure, we can do this, but here's what we're going to do. I think it's better to use these materials, and we're going to have to do this and do all this grading. Fine. But here's the deal. You don't ask your architect to go in and actually hammer and nail everything. You don't ask them to put all the woodwork up and the electricity and all that stuff. You have somebody who is separate. Same thing with your financial advisor. I go in for a strategy. I go in for a plan. I'm going to ask my advisor to devise this, like the architect. Here are my goals. Put something together for me that's going to get me to my goals. That's what the financial advisor does. The planner does that. The planner then says, okay, here's the strategy. We got to take it to the builder. The builder in this case is the investment team, somebody who's behind the scenes that understands how these things work. They work together as a team together. And the three of you, in fact, there may even be more people than that. I'm just using two.
There are, because obviously the general contractor sits at the top of the hill.
There you go.
And he has all kinds of
subcontractors. Right, they're everywhere. Right.
I think that in financial planning, usually that architect plays quarterback.
Yes.
And coordinates all the different advisors.
Exactly.
There's tax issues. Well, you don't want your financial planner making tax recommendations.
No.
They can certainly bring up the issue. They're taught and trained. I know I trained thousands of them to recognize where the tax opportunities are. But as you know, I mm-hmm. have some very, very good relationships and contacts with CPAs. But then I also have an engineer. Now, what does an engineer have to do with tax accounting? Why would I have a relationship, a personal friendship, and an individual that is super knowledgeable in tax planning? I'll tell you why. Because an engineer can go into a business owner, let's say they own their own building, and they can look at the depreciation schedules within that building, which are typically 39 years, and he can say, well, wait a minute. I'm looking at the lights in this studio. Do these have a 39-year life? No, they got like a 5-year life. Well, if you specifically identify certain aspects of a business, tenant improvements, landscaping, elevators, not all of the assets in a building of the structure mm-hmm. are subject to the 39-year depreciation schedule on the building. And it could be in a residential property as well. So you can depreciate them more quickly. And anybody knows that if you can depreciate something over 10 years instead of 39 years, you have a higher income tax deduction today. That velocity of money is putting more cash in your mm-hmm. pocket. That's just one little itsy bitsy
right.
example of how you need to have
a team. A
team.
This is what works. And if you want to use that architect analogy again, yes, you're going to have landscapers. You're going to have people who specialize in this. I've seen buildings go up where they have 15, they have concrete people. They have all this stuff. All headed, of course, by the architect and then the general contractor himself. But this is why you need a team, because I don't want my architect telling me, you know, how the cement should be brushed together. You know,
well,
they might know something about it, but they don't actually do it. And the same thing, I'm not sure I want my financial planner going in and actually doing the trading.
Well, you don't.
And
I mean, this is crazy. If anybody that's been a financial planner, and I was one for like 40 years, knows that you spend the bulk of your time doing planning with your client, and you're on the phone, you're answering questions, you're answering emails, you're doing stuff, and it ain't picking stocks. It's not actually managing portfolios. And I have maybe met one or two that could do both, but not very in my mega year career.
Yeah.
Not met very many that can manage your portfolio with one hand and then juggle your entire financial plan with the other.
I don't want that, personally. Even if they think they can do it, and even if they're pretty good at it, eventually some ball is going to get dropped somewhere, and I'd rather not have that.
Well,
I'd
I want to know. I mean, here's the thing. If you've got a portfolio and you own Facebook and Facebook dropped, I want to know why you have that in the portfolio. And if you can't answer that question really effectively, I want to wring your neck. So it's probably better that you have a real live money manager on the line that can answer that question, because you don't want to get your neck wrung.
Absolutely. And it's even better if they have it all kind of in-house together, I would suggest.
Okay, we'll take a break on that note.
How's that?
I didn't know we were going to like use mafioso terms here. We'll be back. Don't go away.
Business owner, want a bpreneur, or just looking to manage your assets? You found the right place. Biz Talk Radio.
Welcome back, folks. This is the Ray Lucia Show. Happy to have you on board with us. 844 Ray Show emails coming up in just a bit. RayLucia.com. All right, so I read this headline: charitable giving by taxpayers who don't itemize plunges. Here's what we found out. New research from United Way Worldwide, analyzing charitable giving trends in the U.S. over the past decade, finds a steady decrease in the share of taxpayers who donate to nonprofit groups, with the biggest decline coming among those who do not itemize their tax deductions. Okay, so ask and you shall receive. It all depends on, you know, what the tax policy is, and the tax policy today has changed a little bit. I'm not criticizing it, because I think a lot of people have been helped, but not everyone, and charities are in many cases feeling the brunt, especially in the smaller donation range. I mean, obviously, if you're a billionaire, you don't really care that much about it. You're still going to get some kind of a tax deduction, and most billionaires are not doing it for the tax bennies. Johnny Dean, I know you've written on this a couple of times. Mm-hmm. It's pretty interesting. Between 2004 and 2014, the percentage of non-itemizers who give to charity dropped from 52% to 40%, while giving from itemizers fell from 88% to 82%. But the important note here is this. Taxpayers who itemized gave more than twice as much to charity as those that did not, 3504 compared to 1329. They looked at 9,000 people.
Is that since the law changed, or just?
Well, no, this is from 2004 to 2014.
Yeah, okay. So, yeah. Well, you would expect that. I mean, you know, one of the incentives to give to charity is the tax break that you get. Now, you might say, well, you should be giving anyway if you feel like it. And there are obviously people who do that. But there are those, I would suggest, who give more, because they realize that, hey, I'm going to give this money anyway to charity, I might as well get a tax break from it, which I think is good.
The Tax Policy Center, they say here, estimated that the new tax law, which increased the standard deduction, as everybody knows, $12,000 for individuals, $24,000 married couples, would cut the number of households claiming an itemized deduction for charitable donations from about 37 million to about 16 million in 2018. It would reduce the federal income tax subsidy for charitable giving from some $63 billion to about $42 billion. So obviously, when you're not getting the tax write-off, many people might take a pass on, I hope you don't, by the way, on donating to charity. So there are a couple of things that you can do and still make it income tax deductible. John Dean will tell you about one. That's pretty simple.
Well, there is one, and I know you'll give another one. I'm going to give the one for the people who are at least required minimum distribution age, which means that you are at least, you've already reached your 70 and a half birthday. You're at least 70 and a half. It doesn't work. You know, you may have a required minimum distribution this year, but you're not yet 70 and a half. You have to be after age 70 and a half. You can do what's called a qualified charitable distribution, QCD. And what these do is take the money from, let's say, your IRA, where you had, I'm going to make it up, you got a $100,000 IRA, you have like a $4,000 required minimum distribution this year. Well, your plan was this year, over the course of this year, to give $4,000 to some charity, your church, whatever it happens to be. Well, instead of taking the $4,000 out, as you would for your required minimum distribution, putting it on your tax return, and then writing the $4,000 worth of checks this year to your charity, thus ostensibly washing them out. What you would do instead is take the instruct the brokerage, whoever is doing your required minimum distribution, say, send that $4,000 directly to the charity. Don't send it to me. That's what a qualified charitable distribution is. Now, some people will say, well, what's the difference?
Well,
why does it matter?
Well, it qualifies for the required minimum distribution. That's the difference. And so in one case, it is basically taxable income to you. And in the other case, it's like you don't receive the income. So if you don't receive the income, you don't have to pay tax on it.
Yeah, and see, here's the problem. Because even though if I did it the normal way, I took it as a as income for my required minimum distribution, $4,000, and I wrote a $4,000 check, it would seem like, okay, it's a wash. What's the big deal? But because it went onto my tax return, because I claimed it as income, this could and often does affect other income, which means that, now I use an example of $4,000. Some people have much bigger ones, but it could actually affect your Social Security because you're adding income, which means that that income, it goes on to your AGI, that could create a taxable situation with your Social Security, to just name one thing. I believe it's always better if you can just leave it off your tax return
completely.
Well,
it's going to be taxable
either
way.
From your taxable income.
Whether it affects your Social Security or not, it still affects your personal income tax. It's going to add, if you're in the 12%
right.
bracket or 22% bracket, you're paying 12 or 20.
Exactly.
And if it goes directly to the charity, it qualifies for the RMD.
Yes.
And you don't have to pay any tax on
right.
it.
Right. So even if I didn't get a deduction, because you're right, if I took the income and I wrote a $4,000 check, but I don't itemize, I don't get the deduction.
That's right.
It's just income. You're right. So this way, it's as if I got what they might say a de facto tax deduction for it. So qualified charitable distribution, that's one. Now, what if you're not age 70?
Okay, so here's another strategy. All right. Now, this won't impact everyone. But most people that have a portfolio, whether it be an IRA or a brokerage account or whatever, are paying some kind of a fee. They're paying a fee to an advisor, a manager, or whatever. Say it's 1%. Now, those fees in years past were deductible as a miscellaneous itemized deduction. But they're no longer deductible as a miscellaneous itemized deduction. So if you can't deduct the fee, here's my suggestion. My suggestion is you talk to your brokerage firm, your financial planning firm or whatever, and ask them. I mean, you can't tell them to not charge you a fee. All right, that's not going to work.
Don't charge me a fee. There, plain and simple.
Because it's not deductible. But what they can do is perhaps relocate where that fee comes from. Because if you paid the fee directly from your IRA to them, in other words, you're not taking the money out and then paying them. The IRA is paying the fee. That's tantamount to actually getting a tax deduction because it's income that you're not ever going to have to report. So there's a little strategy mm-hmm. for you. You know, somebody that's got a $500,000 portfolio that's paying $5,000 in annual fees, that deduction could have been worth, a couple of thousand dollars to you.
Sure, easily.
So now you can still get the deduction by not getting the deduction, just having the IRA pay the fee for you.
And I know somebody's going to say, well, wait a minute, I'm not even 59 and a half. What about a penalty and blah, blah, blah? The point is that the IRA pays it directly. If you don't receive it, there's
right.
no penalty, there's no income tax on it.
That's right. So talk to your tax advisor about all this stuff, but it really is important because every little bit counts when it comes to tax deductions. And while most people have benefited by the new tax bill, there are several that are still like in, I don't want to say Neverland because that's in the news too, but you're in limbo here on whether, and you haven't filed your taxes or you're on extension or whatever, and you don't know what the impact has been and may not know for a few months what the impact of the new tax bill has been. Please sit down with the appropriate advisors and get to know it, because hey, an extra couple of $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 in deductions could make a big difference.
If you can get around it anyway, why even bother with the law? Just make it deductible again.
Why even bother with the law?
Yes.
Somebody's going to take that out of context.
I know they are, but
they're
why even
say,
bother
Dean,
making that law?
The Ray Lucia show said,
okay, why
don't bother with the law?
No. You know I didn't say that.
Because he fought the law.
And guess who won?
Starting a business can be tough.
This is BizTalk Radio.
Keep listening to this station or take us on the go by downloading our free smartphone app, BizTalk Radio.
Well, the market, the bull market, we are now beyond the 10th year. How cool is that? A lot of people are still freaking out about it. I probably get something from Harry Dent or one of his cohorts, John, two or three times a day. Seriously.
You know, why do people, why? I don't understand. You know, you don't see, when you have a bull market that's 10 years in length, and we've been hearing this for years. I mean, for at least the last 4 or 5 years. It's going to end any time. It's going to end any time. Well, it hasn't. Why don't you hear that on the downside? You know, when you have an extended bear market, you don't have everybody saying, I'm really optimistic. Can't wait. It's going to come back. I mean, it's always the bad news. People are preparing themselves.
There's also a couple of things, and you've got some numbers there I want you to share with our folks here. But I want to talk about this whole market timing thing for just a moment, because as I've mentioned many times on this program, you not only have to make the decision when to get out, but that decision when to get in, back in, is absolutely critical. Here's Johnny's going to go through some by the numbers.
Well, here's,
you should have a jingle for that when you do the by the numbers.
I should, but it's a
in the year
registered
2525.
If man is still alive. Yeah. Okay, so this is according to BTN Research. I'm not sure I understand this completely, why they said this, but anyway. S&P 10 years in length, S&P 500, bull market, as of the close of last Friday, it has gained 400.1% over the period. 400% over those 10 years. The best 2 years out of those 10 years for the S&P 500 were the first year. So you remember, that was 2009 to, 2010 March. First year, it was up 72.3%, which you might expect. And the fifth year, up 23.7%, which would have been, I guess, 2013, I think. The worst 2 years out of the 10 years were the seventh year, where it says it was down 2.2%.
That has to be not including dividends, because I've got it right here. It was up, including dividends, 2015. 1.4%.
Yeah, it had to be.
Yeah, it was up 1.4%.
They say it includes dividends, but that's not right. And then this 2018, or, you know, just the, 2017 to 20, I'm sorry, 2018 to 2019, this last year, it was up just 0.4%. So it says it includes total return results, including impact of reinvested dividends. I don't think so. Okay, one more thing here, which you're going to find very interesting, I think, Ray. The total return for the S&P 500 over this 10-year bull market, since March 10th, 2009, was a gain of 17.5% per year total return.
See, that blew me away. I thought it was 12 or 14%, but not 17. That is huge. Think about the poor souls that pulled their money out of the market, and like our good buddy, you know who I'm talking about, who still aren't back in. They left 17%. Yep. On the table, that's
per
nuts.
Year. Per year.
Wow.
Now, here's the thing that you might find interesting. If you missed the 20 during that 10 years.
Well, hang on a second.
Yeah.
Does it have what the first year recovery was? How much you gained back year one? In other words, how much?
Well, like in the previous one that I said, the best year out of those 10 years was the March 9th, 2009 to March 9th, 2010.
And how much was that?
72.3%.
I'm sorry. I must have missed that.
That's right.
So just think about that, folks, for just a moment. So these dudes and dudettes that say, well, they can get you out and get you back in. If they get you in a year late, because they're still waiting for that dead cat bounce or whatever the heck they're talking about, you miss out on 72%. That first year back out of the bear is usually a huge, huge return.
Oh, absolutely. And you know there are people who say, well, I got you out. I got you out in early 2008. You missed the whole downturn. When'd you get back in? I'm still waiting.
Yeah.
All right. So the total return was 17.5%. Now, if you missed the 20 best percentage gain days over that entire year, 10 years,
so there's 2,000 some odd trading days?
You have 2,517 trading days, and you rank them all according to, best performer at number one. So let's say you missed the top 20 of the best days. Instead of 17.5% per year, you cut your return in half to 8.6% annual gain. In other words, 20 of those 2,500 plus trading days, were responsible for about 50% of the entire gain during that 10-year period of time. I mean, if that doesn't tell you that you cannot time the market in and out, then I don't know what will.
So it cut it in half to about 8.5%?
Yeah, 8.6, correct.
8.6%.
Yeah.
You know me, I like playing with my calculator.
I know you do.
So if you had $100,000, that $100,000, if you did nothing. Remember I said early in the program, I like boring? Yeah. So if you were like totally boring, your $100,000 is worth $500,000 today. And if you missed the 20 best days and made 8.5%, it's worth $228,000. Less than half. Now, nobody's going to miss the 20 best days and
it's for emphasis.
Yes, that too. But here's the thing. You must be in the market to enjoy the benefits of the market. And this is the genius really behind a bucketized portfolio, if I do say so. Because in a bucketized portfolio, you are boring. Because whatever money that you put into the stock market, A, you diversify. Of course you diversify. But B, you leave it alone. Do you do rebalancing? Sure, you can do rebalancing. Do you have to? Not necessarily. But it's usually a good idea. Because the rebalancing is done up front. And it's done up front by calculating on a present value basis how much in safe money you will need to draw from to allow the markets to do what they're gonna do. So anybody that followed that kind of a strategy over the last 10 years is feeling pretty good. Maybe they made 17 and a half, maybe they made 16, maybe they made 12, but they certainly made a decent amount of money on the portion that they left alone. Those that tried to get in and tried to get out, well, maybe some of them earned 30%. I don't know. If they did, go to Barnes & Noble and look for their book, because that's how they're going to make money in the future. They're not going to make it timing the market. The stock market graveyard is littered with those kinds of individuals who were right once or twice, but they're not going to be right consistently.
It's good advice to go write a book, make your money, and get out, because as you said, that's the only way you're really going to do it over the long term. Go back to... We don't pick on Elaine Garzarelli, and I don't even know if anybody even knows who she is anymore. Is she still?
She's kind of faded into the. I haven't seen or heard of her in a while.
I don't do this to pick on her, but it's to use it as an example. There's nothing wrong with her. It's just that she happened to be. I think she was in the 80s. I think in 87,
yeah.
She called something that said we're going to, you know, something's going to happen, and it did. Well, she got right. You got a luck. I don't want to say lucky. Maybe she did. I don't know. It looks to me like luck, but whatever. Beyond that, so everybody kind of turns to her and says, ah, well, what do you see? What do you see? And as far as I know, I don't think she hit another one. And that's nothing wrong with her. Yeah, it's just that you can't predict it.
I followed her. She was at Solomon. I quit following her when she, I think she left Solomon Brothers.
Well, the fact that we're still talking about her 30-something years later.
Yeah, isn't that crazy?
I mean, that's pretty good for her.
87, 97.
It's 32 years.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, 32 years.
It's been that long.
I know that because I'd just gotten married at the time, and so I know how long I've been married.
Oh, well, that's good. Yeah. I've sort of been married so long, I'm forgetting.
I know.
I want to bring this up. How much time do we have?
About 2 minutes.
Okay. 8 Costly Retirement Mistakes to Avoid by Mark Hendricks. I just want to run through these because we've talked about all of them. 1, timing. The risk you'll retire during a bear market. We solve that problem with the safe money bucket. 2, inflation. The chances that inflation will erode your purchasing power. True and false at the same time, because while inflation goes up, spending goes down. Therefore, most people are not going to experience massive amounts of inflation. Not that we even have much inflation today and are not likely to have much, in my opinion, in the future. But even if we did, your spending will go down at a faster clip in most instances than the inflation rate going up. 3, longevity, the chance you'll outlive your money. We have discussed that ad nauseum, but critically important. 4, interest rates, the risk you won't be able to get an adequate return on your safer debt instruments. This is why we diversify into other assets that might produce better rates of return, whether it be income from real estate or annuities, and this is why you have a combo plate of fixed income investments. 5, investor behavior. The risk you'll dump stocks in a temporary downdraft. You have nobody to blame but yourself.
I'd put that at the top.
Oh, it is. These aren't in any order.
You can't really solve for that. I mean, you can, but.
Next, withdrawal rate risk. The risk of taking out too much too soon. 7, cognitive decline. Another topic we've spent hours on in this program. Remember, your cognition drops while your confidence stays level. That's a recipe for disaster. And finally, health care costs, which we also talk about 2 or 3 times a week. Those are the 8 costly retirement mistakes to avoid. Do you have a plan in place to mitigate the risk of all 8? We do. Stick around. Emails are next. This is the Ray Lucia Show.
This is Winflow from Progressive.
All right, we're back. This is the Ray Lucia Show. Billionaire Sam Zell talks about wealth redistribution won't work. Americans don't want handouts. I think that's true. I think Americans don't want handouts. I brought this up earlier. I know we got to get to emails, but there's so many of these stories. NFL players and NBA players. I don't know if you knew this. 78% of NFL football players are broke, bankrupt within 2 years. 60% NBA players.
Within 2 years of retiring,
yeah,
leaving
retiring.
The NBA.
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. Oh, I believe it. How many times have we seen that? Sure.
Lottery winners, same thing. I mean, the story goes on and on. The way that people deal with money is really kind of sick and crazy.
You know what this points out, though? This all, NBA, NFL, lottery winners, it doesn't matter. What it points out is the importance of having a strategy that takes care of your distribution needs. This is what happens at retirement. It can be easy in many respects to get the money. Whether you win it, you're an NBA player, or you just work real hard your whole life, right? But the important part after that is, how do you spend it? Because I can make $2 million a year, but if I'm spending $2.1 million, it doesn't do any good.
Do you remember back in the day, I think you had a relative or something at one of the big computer companies locally?
Yes.
And their stock price went through the ceiling. And I've told this story before.
Yes, it did.
So I met with this back when I was doing planning. I don't do this stuff anymore. Yeah. But I went out to their place in La Jolla. And a nice little house and a beautiful family, 3 kids, wife. And they had, I think it was AMCC or one of the small tech companies.
Yes, you're right.
Locally, was it?
Yes.
Yeah, so I'm remembering this. And this guy went from nothing to like $4 million bucks overnight. So he's got $4 million. And he calls me up and says, I'd like to talk to you about a plan. Well, as it turns out, it was mostly his wife that wanted to talk about the plan. And so what I did is I pulled out my calculator and said, listen, what you guys should do is sell enough of this stock. Because he didn't want to sell a nickel of it.
It was stock options. Yeah. It was unbelievable.
Sell enough of this stock so that you have some semblance of financial security. Pay off the mortgage and then maybe invest so that you could take, 4% out, get $50,000 a year of income, like for the rest of your life. So you have a free and clear home and 50 grand. You're not going to be millionaires, but you're financially secure. You'll be able to pay your kids' education costs, et cetera, et cetera. Well, he goes ballistic. I mean, he and his wife get in this massive fight because she's on my side. I do well with the women. She's on my side, and he is like his beet red. He is so mad. So I said, I think I'll let you guys talk about this. I called him back. They wouldn't even answer the phone.
This wasn't my relative then.
No, it wasn't your relative.
Oh, okay.
I mean, because I had a relative that was
I do. Okay, excuse me. I thought you were, I thought, did he meet with you?
Oh, no.
Okay,
no.
Good, because this is not
they had the same company
okay,
stock.
Good,
I think
good.
It was AMCC.
It may have been. All right. Okay, good. I thought that.
Do you have a relative that had
well, he used to work, and the one that I'm talking about, he actually did what you suggested. My relative did that. Who had in 1 year, the options just were
unbelievable.
1,000 times worth what he paid for.
Right.
So he had all this money. What he did was he took about half after a
That's
year or
I
two.
That's what I recommended they do. Right.
He took about half, and he's a big listener to the program, too. and sold it off and did exactly what you suggested. Now, the other half went into the tank.
They pummeled. Yeah, they got pummeled.
But what he was able to do was, based on what you were talking about here, he actually left that company, now in business for himself, takes a lot of vacations, has a very nice home. It's all paid for, big everything, and it worked because he wasn't greedy. He wasn't greedy.
Okay, so anyway. Patience pays. Do we have time for an email?
Sure.
Go ahead.
I don't know if we have time for these two that I have
here.
You
got mail.
Oh, right. I always forget for the cue. Wait. Chris. Let's see. I'm 39 years old. I make almost $250,000. Wow. Is right. $250,000 at age 39. I heard you discussing Roth alternatives. Can I use an IUL, Index Universal Life? And if so, why is that better than just using mutual funds? Well, we kind of discussed this, I think, a little bit last week.
We did. That's probably why he sent us the email. Chris, it actually is not a bad strategy. Why is it? I don't want to say better, because I can always, you know, if I have the pen in this hand, on the other hand, I got another. Yeah, you know how that whole joke goes. But here's the thing. With some of these index universal life policies, if you die too soon, you get a life insurance policy. If you live too long, you get a tax-free income like you would, say, from a Roth IRA. Or if you get sick along the way, you get other accelerated benefits. It's kind of hard. I mean, you can still do that with a Roth, but you make, what'd you say, $250,000 a year? $6,000 ain't going to cut it for you, dude. I mean, do the Roth if you can, but you can't. You make too much money. So you got to put money somewhere. Now, you could put it in the straight mutual funds. But you'd still have to buy life insurance. That's a cost. You'd still have to buy some form of disability or chronic illness, critical care benefit riders, and so forth. You're still going to have disability plans and so forth. So for me, it's a better deal. Now, if you own mutual funds, you'll also still have to pay taxes. People think, John, they're putting their money into a managed account. They get dividends, they get capital gains, they get short-term gains. Mm-hmm. You pay tax on that. That tax is going to have an impact on your return. With an IUL, that's an Index Universal Life, you don't pay tax on that. It's tax deferred, and then if you do it right, the income comes out tax-free. Now, it's not for everybody, but I think it is. What's his name again? Charles? No?
Chris.
For you, I knew it was a C. For you, Chris, I think whoever is advising you is probably giving you pretty good advice.
Let's do one more really quickly. If I gift my kids $50,000 each to buy a house, do I pay the taxes or should I be an owner with them? In other words, should I be on the loan?
I don't totally understand that, but you shouldn't be on the loan if you can avoid being on the loan. You shouldn't be on title if you can avoid being on the title. You may not be able to avoid being on title and on the loan, but if it were me, I don't want to be on title on a house that my kid owns, because now you're a joint owner, and if your kid throws some big beer pong party and somebody gets really, really drunk or causes a fight or falls off the balcony, somebody's going to get sued, and since you're a joint owner, it's going to be you. Because you have assets. So I would be very cautious here. Now, do you have to pay taxes on the gift? I think that was in there somewhere.
Yes.
The answer is no. You can make a gift. You're supposed to file Form 709. Whether you do or not is a question of statute of limitations. It has nothing to do with paying taxes or not paying taxes, because you got like $11 million exemption. So I wouldn't worry much about the tax implications, but I would worry about the legal implications. Fair enough?
Fair enough.
We're out of time. Thank you, folks, for tuning in. Go to RayLucia.com, click on the Ask Ray button. Now make it a blessed day. Bye-bye.
You're listening to The Ray Lucia Show, bringing you the best in money information, answering questions about your biggest financial challenges, talking about your money, your business, and your life. Ray Lucia is not a registered representative of or affiliated with any securities brokerage or investment advisory firm. The views and opinions expressed by Ray and his guests are not necessarily those of this station or its sponsors and should not be construed as legal, tax, or investment advice. You should always consult with the appropriate advisors before making any financial decisions. Ray is available to take
your questions. This is Biz Talk Radio, America's home.